Happy Thursday and welcome back to another episode of the Embodied Podcast. Today I have an interview with Hillary Jacobs Hendel. Hillary is a certified psychoanalyst and she is a AEDP psychotherapist and supervisor. She wrote a book on emotions called It's Not Always Depression, Working with the Change Triangle to Listen to the Body, Discover Core Emotions, and Connect to Your Authentic Self. This interview was incredible, probably one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. Hillary is so relatable and just so innately sweet and human, and the way she speaks in this interview really is translated into the work in her book. And so if you really want to understand the complex world of emotions and make them a little bit more digestible and easier to understand, check out this interview. It was wonderful. I do always like to take some time and space to say thank you to those of you who have rated and reviewed the podcast. And so if you want to drop a 5-star rating or a written review in iTunes, I would really appreciate it. And then one last thing, because it is in the heart of launch season for my upcoming Born to Heal cohort, and Born to Heal is my 12-week signature group course focused all around emotional work and exploring your inner landscape. And I figure it would be good to talk about it before this interview in particular. So if things in this interview resonate with you deeply, please go to the show notes and put in an application for the Born to Heal course, because all of this stuff that Hillary and I speak about are the things that I focus on in the Born to Heal cohort over the 12-week program. So without further ado, on to the show. All right, friends, welcome back to the Embodied Podcast. Today, I am joined by Hillary Jacobs Hendel. Hillary, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
I am so excited to chat through the work that you do in the world and your book, It's Not Always Depression, because that book, I read it. It was actually before COVID hit, and it was such a lovely read because it was so digestible and it was just such a breath of fresh air into this kind of inner work. And the one thing that I found that made the book so fruitful, and we just actually talked about this, was like, it was so human, like just the most human. And it made you as an author seem so relatable. And it just made you want to keep reading and keep reading. So thank you for bringing humanity into this work that you do in the world.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. That really was my intent, only because it's such a relief since we are all humans and humans are wonderful and lovable and deeply flawed. And if we have to go around pretending,
it's exhausting.
It's hard. It doesn't make us feel good. And there's no reason for it. And so I really appreciate it.
So what really inspired you to write a book like this?
That's very clear in my mind, is I had stumbled on, I had graduated from social work school it's like a third or fourth career. It took me a long time to find myself. And I kind of stumbled. I was going to become a psychoanalyst, which was a sort of the thing to do when you want to be really good at what you do and you want to get a good education. And in New York City, being trained in a 4-year postgraduate certification in psychoanalysis was something that I thought I could do that would help me be the best therapist that I could be. And then on my way to going into that training, I just stumbled on a conference that introduced a whole other way of working as a therapist that had to do with emotions and the body and this idea that we're all traumatized to a little or a lot degree, depending on the life experiences that happen to us and how much support and how many tools we have to deal with adversity. And so this was a method called AEDP that was developed by Diana Fossia, and it was so much on emotions, and I really could hear it for the first time in my life because it was so grounded in science. And I was raised by a psychiatrist father, and we didn't really, dealing with emotions in the body were still considered like kind of California woo-woo new age. And so I didn't really think of it as sort of legitimate, and I didn't know there was a science around it. And so when I went to this conference, my mind was really blown. It changed my whole life. And so I decided I was going to train in this way at the same time I was going to train in this way that probably pleased my father, I thought, or that was sort of more legitimate. And then through practicing in this new method, which I thought and still think is just, I guess I want to use the word superior. It's not a word I like to use that much, but it just helps people. It's a healing modality as opposed to insight. And it really changes the brain. And we're capitalizing on the current neuroscience and how you change brains for the better. But what also happened is that I started to feel annoyed that this information was so circumscribed to us, just to the few thousand of therapists that at the time had trained in this method and their patients. And in particular, there was this diagram that showed how emotions worked in the mind and body that was called the triangle of experience. And I thought that this was easy enough to understand that anybody, maybe a teenager or older, could grasp it. So it was about a decade after practicing this method of psychotherapy that it occurred to me that it would be good to try to reach the public at large, that if universities and psychological programs and social work programs weren't going to teach this, then maybe I could get a grassroots type of movement of people that were educated in emotions and the body and how people heal, that it would help turn the tides so that this would become a mainstream model instead of sort of relegated to experiential or trauma models. Because I really think, CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is considered empirically validated and, the way to go, is half the piece of the puzzle. So we have to understand our thoughts and cognitions, as they're technically called in the jargon, and we have to understand how emotions work in the body and how it all fits together. So I started writing little articles. Then I had an article go viral in the New York Times on this kind of work. And then through that, I was asked to write a book on the topic. And I just chose to really teach this tool as a teachable, usable tool that anybody could sort of incorporate into a mindfulness practice. It's really a map for what's happening inside us.
Yeah. So you call that in the book the change triangle.
Yes. I nicknamed it.
Yeah. So can you kind of talk us through a little bit of that triangle and how that works?
Sure. So basically it's an upside down triangle. So anyone who's listening that's near a computer can just Google the change triangle to see an image of it, because a picture is worth 1,000 words. But if you're not, just visualize an upside down triangle that's superimposed on your body, with the point of the triangle being somewhere around your belly button. And then the top of the flat top of the triangle kind of being somewhere between your shoulders and the top of your head. And there's three corners of the triangle, and then there's something underneath the triangle. So it's mapping the top of the triangle are the ways that we avoid emotions. And they're with this category that the top left of the triangle is called defenses. And defenses, by definition, are anything we do to avoid feeling uncomfortable. And it ranges from, reaching for an alcoholic beverage at the end of the day, to walking out of a conversation when we're uncomfortable, to when someone gives us a compliment saying, no. There's a myriad of defenses, and it's very interesting when you look at this. I have, there's a list of them in the book that you read, and there's a list of them on my website. But it's the ways that we avoid emotions. And so we often see those in others more than we see them in ourselves. And the main thing to know about defenses is that they're not bad, that they really served us at the time that they formed. We're not born with defenses. They're a reaction to having to survive difficult and challenging moments. So that's the top left corner of the triangle. And then the top right hand corner of the triangle is inhibitory emotions. These are the emotions that we use to push down our core emotions, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Those are at the bottom of the triangle. And the inhibitory emotions are anxiety and guilt and shame, something no one is spared. We're all familiar with those. And in little bits, those are very healthy. They have very, there's positive attributes to these emotions. They keep us socialized. They keep us connected, worrying about kind of how people are responding to us and what's the quote unquote right thing to do. That's where we have sort of healthy guilt and healthy shame. But when we have too much of that, which suppresses our these core emotions, which are at the bottom of the triangle that are in our body, then if we have too much inhibition, then we don't feel well. We get disconnected from ourselves. And so what this, the core emotions, which are at the bottom of the triangle, are anger, fear, sadness, disgust, joy, excitement, and sexual excitement. And there's other emotions, for like love, for example, and longing and jealousy. And, you know, there's many emotions, there's many feelings really, but these, there's not that many core emotions, and I'll explain what core emotions are. I'm going to give you a pause in a moment to make sure to keep going. But this is the pithiest, the quickest explanation I can give. But the main thing that the takeaway here for people, if they remember nothing else from this talk, is that these core emotions of anger, sadness, fear, disgust, joy, excitement, and sexual excitement, that these are wired in programs that are supposed to be there from the moment that we're born. We can't stop them from happening. They're the survival programs that evolved for hundreds of thousands of years to help humans evolve and survive. And so, for example, if we didn't have anger in response to being attacked, we wouldn't be able to know to defend ourselves. If we didn't have fear, we wouldn't know to be able to run away. If we didn't have joy and excitement, we wouldn't be prompted to kind of lean into the things that feel good and to the things that interest us. And all those emotions, those core emotions, really are further us in many ways. But we live in this emotion phobic society, which kind of teaches us to avoid emotions because we don't have any emotion education, and emotions can be painful and overwhelming and scary. And so my intent was to demystify the whole process. So there's, and the, and if you, there's this one part underneath the triangle, which we can envision as our authentic self when we feel our best, when we're calm and when we're, we feel connected and curious in the world, and we feel we can engage with other people and engage with our interests, and we feel confident in ourselves and courageous. And so the whole idea is that we are revolving around the different corners of the change triangle throughout the day and throughout our lives. But when we get, when something in the environment happens that triggers one of these core emotions, we're at a crossroads for whether we block them and avoid them or whether we move through them to come out the other side and kind of more solidify this authentic self. We have more access to it. And the more we can embrace our emotions and work with them through noting them in the body, not going up into our head and ruminating about them, the more it, from a scientific standpoint, integrates our brain and regulates our nervous system, which translates to feeling better, less anxious, less depressed, more engaged in life, and more vital.
So do you think that the first step is really noticing in the body
what's happening?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the first step, because I'm a left brain person that needs to understand, and that's what prompted me to start writing about this. The first step for me was the intellectual understanding of emotions and this triangle, so that when I finally had the courage to tune into my body, to feel the sensations that all core emotions bring, that I knew what to expect. There's the nice thing about emotions, even though we're all different, emotions work the same way for all of us. And when you understand, for example, core emotions in their pure form, when they're not mixed and bonded and mushed in with other emotions, are these wave-like experiences that sort of rise in intensity and then they calm down. Somewhat to like when you stub your toe and you know, when you stub your toe, it's sort of like, you know, you're about to feel it soon. It doesn't come on right away. And then the pain builds and then you reach the top of the crescendo of the pain and then you start to feel better. So when someone leans into an emotion that through the body, through sensations, like I'll often ask people, if you told me right now that you were feeling happy, I would ask you, how do you know what in your body is telling you that you're having this emotion of happiness? Mm-hmm. And you would be able to kind of scan your body below the neck from head to toe and see what sensations were coming up. And it might take you a little time to be able to find the right word, because it's almost like learning a new language. It's like,
totally
like learning Japanese in a way. If you speak English, that you have to be patient with yourself. Sometimes you need tools and lists of words to reference, but sure enough, if you give yourself the time and space and you slow way down, these sensations start to come into focus. Like when you're driving into a fog and then you finally can start to see the shapes of things that when you're coming out of it.
Mm. So what happens for the people who have really, really suppressed those emotions for a long time? Like, what's the window into those emotions? Is it working through the defenses and the inhibitory emotions first? Is that the first step then?
That's such a great question, Danielle. Yes. So it really depends on the person. So if someone has had a lot of trauma, like abuse and consistent emotional neglect, right? We all have, to a certain degree, emotional neglect because our parents had their own traumas and couldn't be with us with certain emotions. Like my mother couldn't really do sadness that well. She was really into cheering me up. And the result of that was that I was sort of scared of my sadness. I avoided it. And then instead of feeling sad, I would feel anxious. So what happens is when we bury our core emotions, what we end up feeling is anxiety, or we might first notice a feeling of shame or embarrassment in an emotional moment, or we might feel guilty and we don't know why. And it may have something to do with feeling guilty about our emotions, because we got the impression when we were little that they were hurting our parents. For example, anger, a lot of people, and again, I'm a parent of four, parents have the best intent, but we only know what we were taught by our own and modeled by our own parents. And so to answer your question, when I meet somebody new and they come into my practice, oftentimes they're going to come in with their defenses, which are the same as their symptoms, right? So they're going to bring me what is the trouble. And we can, in ADP, what we try to do first and foremost is just, we respect the defenses, we value them, right? We honor why they're here to protect us. And then we ask them politely to, if they would move over so that we could be with what's happening underneath. So what that looks like, for example, is let's say you come in and you're just talking, telling me lots and lots of stories. And I would say something like, I'm so interested in everything that you're saying. And I'm wondering if we could really slow way down to notice what you're feeling as you're talking. And so in that case, the talking is a little bit of a defense, right? It's not a hard defense, but it's sort of a little bit driven by anxiety, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so just at the mere suggestion, if we could slow down and kind of just check into the body and notice what's happening, many people can do that right away. Another example is if someone comes in with a lot of self-deprecation, I am terrible, a lot of self-judgment. I'll simply ask, can we ask the judgmental parts of you to wait in the waiting room for a moment so we can see what the underlying feelings are as you share this story of how you made a mistake at work.
So what happens to the person who really hasn't experienced themselves with different parts of themselves and they think that they are them and that's it and they're one thing and they're judgmental and that's all, that's who they are? How do you really kind of allow them to see those different parts and bring them forward?
Mm-hmm. That's also a great question. So the idea, I think most people, believe it or not, relates to the idea of parts of themselves. And let me just define what I'm talking about. We all have the experience where we can say to ourselves, well, I'm ambivalent. A part of me wants to go to this party, for example, or wants to go back to school, or wants to go to this meeting. And a part of me really doesn't. So that's the idea, that we're in conflict and we can get to know each aspect of our conflict. So in something like that, I might say, well, can we get to know the part of you that wants to go to this party? Let me hear just from that part. And then we're going to go to the other part, as opposed to, you know, what happens is people get stuck in a loop of ambivalence and they go back and forth. Oh, I'm going to go. Oh, I'm not going to go. Oh, I'm going to go. And what really helps these kind of conflicts is to hear the full story from each part and with all the feelings, right? Each of those parts of ourself might have their own triangle of the emotions that come with, you know, what do you imagine you're going to feel if you go to this party? Oh, well, I'm going to feel self-conscious. Oh, so we understand why you don't want to go. What about the part that wants to go to the party? Well, I want to talk to people. I like people. I like engaging. And so we want to get to know the story for each of those parts and then help reconcile conflicts by understanding ourselves better and then coming up with compromises or with one small step forward that can be manageable so you don't set someone up for failure. And it works very well. It really does work. Now, another way to understand a part for the science nerds listening is that we're really talking about a neural network that can stem from a memory. So the brain is wired so that we learn from experiences that were painful or dangerous to us. So let's say in a moment of exuberance, let's say we go up to our teacher and we're in second grade and we're like, look at this great picture that I did. And the teacher is a bad teacher or a mean teacher and says, that's no better than anybody else's picture. That is such a humiliating and painful experience for a child. It brings up shame, which is the most excruciating emotion that we can probably experience. It's like you just want to disappear. It's an annihilating experience. So the brain is likely to remember encoding in the body that when we, in a moment of exuberance, if we let ourselves be excited and expansive, that's dangerous. We could get shut down. And so what happens in further experiences, it kind of wires in new experience and get wired into that old experience so that now, let's say we did a great job at work and you got a great commendation at work and you want to tell your partner, and you like think twice, because what happens if I go, look, I got this great recommendation at work. The brain is going to remember, well, that didn't work out so well in second grade. And so we're not going to toot our own horn, or that's going to be conceited, or, you know, it's going to make my partner feel bad. The mind's going to come up with all these reasons for why it's not okay to do that in relationships. And so that becomes a part that we would work on in therapy to help heal that early lesson, because it's not serving the person, because their partner, in fact, may want to hear about all the good things that happened at work that day and may be able to rejoice and be exuberant with their partner. And what a wonderful that's a great feeling, and it brings people closer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So it sounds like there's just different sub personalities within yourself, right? Each of those different parts have their own little personality and it has its own little memories, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't really call them sub-personalities only because it brings to mind like the movie Sybil and having, you know, all these like pejorative ideas of like split personalities. I really think of them as aspects of the self. Like I think we have a core personality. Like after therapy or after, you know, doing a mindfulness practice with working the triangle, people feel more themselves, more their best self. And so I think of that as the main kind of personality. And then I think of that we have all these conflicts and these feelings that mute us or that distort our personality. And but if that's a word, you know, whatever word feels right for you or the person I'm with, I don't object to. It's what resonates and is usable.
So is it our job in kind of like a therapeutic setting to really help the parts understand their place in the whole, and then the self makes kind of the ultimate decision because it's coming from the truest and most pure place? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's one way to look at it. So there's a whole method of therapy called internal family systems therapy that Richard Schwartz developed. It's a great method and it marries really well with AEDP. And in that method, yes, and it's the same idea that you have this kind of core self that manages all the different parts of us and kind of thinks through which parts to express and which parts just need comforting and care, that type of thing. In AEDP, it's more like moving over parts, whatever they need to feel calmer and to step back so that we can get to the true self, the true feelings and the true self. It's really the true self, this kind of core sense of self. So when you're in your core sense of self, according to AEDP theory and what I've sensed personally and professionally, you still have feelings. They just don't overtake you, that you sort of see them. Like for example, I'm going to be flying. It's COVID now, and I've made the decision because my stepdaughter lives in California and I'm on the East Coast, and we're going to fly and spend a month in California. And my Jewish worrying part is like, we should not be traveling. That's risky, right? So, and that's like generations, right, of that anxiety that sort of gets passed along. And my mother was a worrier and my grandmother was a worrier. I decided long ago I didn't want to listen to that part. I have it, and as I've worked on it in therapy over the years, its voice is calmer, so I don't have to act on it. I talk to it, and I reason with it, and I comfort it, and with my wise mind and my thoughtful, rational process, look at statistics, look at the odds of what's going to happen, of safety precautions, and I override it. So I may still be aware and feel my fear at times, but it doesn't overtake me in a way that I don't get to act in line with my ultimate goals.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest, I think, takeaway from having this, I wouldn't say emotional intelligence, but relationship with your emotional landscape, because it gives you space and it gives you flexibility and it gives you like this sense of ease where it's like that stuff still happens. I think there's this perception where it's like, well, if I just like work through my emotional stuff, it'll go away. And it's like, no, that stuff still happens to everybody. It's like the most human thing ever. But there's this, it's a difference. It's a yes. Far bigger difference.
Yes, that is so beautiful how you put it, the space, the flexibility, that's what we're building in. And exactly, we never stop having emotions because, like I said before, they're wired into the middle of the brain, they get set off by the environment. That's, you're working well when you have your feelings. It's just we don't want the feelings to take us over so that we're not able to think. We say in AEDP, I believe Diana Focia coined this phrase, that the ultimate, one of the goals of therapy is to help people feel, deal, and relate all at the same time. And I think that's very well said. Yeah. So we want to be able to feel our feelings, deal in life, and relate to the people we're with at the same time. And that's a lifelong practice, right? Because oftentimes something happens, particularly in relationships and particularly in our attachment relationships, right? Either our family of origin or the people that we end up having intimacy with. They have great power to trigger us. And so the process of being able to kind of know that you're being triggered and kind of slow the whole reaction down while you're having this connection with this person so that you don't end up saying something rash that hurts them back and escalating, or you don't retreat into this horrible depression, that you can kind of stay above water and work it, deal with it.
Why do you think it is attachment, that relationship in itself can be one of the most healing containers that we experience in life?
Yeah. Why are relationships healing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're wired for connection, and it's such a beautiful thing that from the moment we're born, and we know this from many, many studies on in infant mother research, that we are initially, before we have a sense of self, it is our mother who soothes our emotions. It's our parents who act as our executive functioning of our brain. So when we're little, we don't have the capacity to soothe ourselves. We need to be held. We need to nurse at the breast. We need to have eye contact. We need to be swaddled. And then when we're a little bit older and we have feelings and we begin to have language, it's our parents that help us make sense of these affects that are coursing through our body. So for example, if I'm a little kid and some other kid pulls away my toy and I start to freak out and go into an infant rage, right? Because little kids have intense anger. It's unmitigated. I don't know if you've been around a lot of kids, but their emotions aren't really muted yet. And then the mother, you know, says something in this different tone. It's fascinating. It's called markedness. So the kid is freaking out and the mother says, "Oh, you're so angry that little kid just took away your toy." And by feeding back the word angry with a different tone, not by being angry, which would scare the kid, by in this kind of gentle tone of voice, the child learns this feeling I'm having is anger. And by being able to put language on a physical experience of an emotion, that's why from the get-go, when I'm working with someone in therapy, we're trying to put language on the sensation of emotion, because that in itself is calming. I understand what's happening to me.
Right.
And that feels better to the body. So relationships start off being healing, and then a lot of bad things happen in relationships, again, because either we're raised by parents that themselves suffer trauma and have suffer addictions and abuse us and hurt us, very, you know, either mostly by accident and sometimes just terrible parents who hurt their children. Then we find relationships to be, those people grow up feeling threatened by relationships. But then when you restore, when you find a good relationship, whether it's with a partner or a therapist or a friend, you're sort of relearning that I can feel better when I share with somebody. I can feel better if I let somebody give me what I'm calling, and this is my next project that I'm working on, a therapeutic hug, a non-sexual soothing touch that has great power to calm an upset nervous system, that has great power to soothe anxiety and depression, fear, so that there's all this capacity that we as human beings can do to help each other. But again, this is something we're not given a lot of education about in high school, where we should be having it, like the change triangle. Should be talking
about. Yeah, I think something you said there that is so important is like literally in relationship, like when you move from one relationship container to another, mm-hmm. it is this relearning process, because not only are you having to deal with your nervous system, it's like that other person has a nervous system too. And it's like this kind of dance that you're just dancing back and forth with. And it is an absolute learning process. And I think that when I was able to get my nervous system under control to the point where it's like, okay, it's soothed, it's okay, then I was able to participate in the dance where it wasn't like, so I was trying to control everything in the relationship because I couldn't take it. I couldn't take their nervous system. I couldn't take my nervous system. So yes, there was a lot of like things I had to do with myself to be able to really just enter into a healthy relationship where the dance is healthy.
Yeah. Right. And you're not alone. There's not one person that doesn't need to do that work. And again, I think it starts with the education, because if you're talking with another person, your partner, who has read It's Not Always Depression, right, and had their basic education in emotions, then you have a language with which to talk about disagreements and what's happening when you're both in your defenses, right? Whether that defense is attacking back when your nervous system, as you say, is in high alert, or whether your defense is to withdraw into like a hole.
And yeah, that was
not
me.
Be able to engage. Yeah. And I'm the one that's kind of coming at you. So then you can like, okay, you can, in those moments, you can say, okay, let's pause. Let's notice what's happening to us, right? I can see that I said something that hurt your feelings. You're escalating, you know, up. I am retreating, or vice versa. Let's rewind. Let's find where our common ground was and what happened in that moment when we went off the rails. And there was probably a misunderstanding, because I know my intention wasn't to have a fight with you. So let's see where we went off the rails and see if we can give each other a redo, or let's take a break and calm down. But I really recommend that couples read the books, the book I wrote, if I can humbly say, together. I sort of wrote it in that, with that intent, that you can read it out loud, you can try some of the exercises, or just build more intimacy by understanding how emotions work for both of you and what you think about the content of what I'm saying, and just have a conversation. Because all in adult relationships, really, all there is talking when it comes to working out conflicts. You just have to keep staying in the game and coming back to it and trying to understand and be understood. And yeah, that really a conversation isn't over. It may be over for the moment, but it shouldn't be over until both people feel understood.
Right. Yeah. 100% agree.
Yeah. That solves like 90% of conflicts. One other thing I just wanted to mention, because most of us don't know it, is that most of the communication happening between two people, this is certainly true with infants and mothers and babies and parents and all the way up, is nonverbal communication. We think we're listening mostly to words, but as anyone in a relationship will attest to, the tone of voice, the facial expressions, what's happening non-verbally trumps what's happening verbally. So someone can say, well, I do love you. And if it's, you know, it's like, well, I don't feel it right now. Yeah. And that's because the tone of voice and the eye contact and the body posture, whether it's threatening or loving, whether the tone of voice is threatening or loving, the gestures, all the thing, those are going straight into the deeper parts of the brain and resonating what's the truth of the experience. Mm-hmm. And once we know that also, we can say things like I often say to my husband when he says, I'll say something like, are you angry at me? And he'll say, no. I'll say, well, then what am I picking up?
Mm.
So that he can think for a moment about what he's doing that may not be happening in words, and try to reflect on, he may say, yeah, well, I am frustrated about this. And then we'll be like, okay, that's what I'm picking up. And then there's like a calming down.
Yeah. It's interesting, because when I was learning to set boundaries, one of the things that I was taught was to, because setting boundaries is a very vulnerable place, especially for me, because I shut down a lot. So like to stand in my truth of my experience was really hard. So something that I was taught was to make eye contact and try to connect with that person, name your experience and say, like, right now I'm feeling this, and look at them in the eyes, because it's really hard for them to really be mean to you if they're looking you in the eyes and they love you. And so it's the truest thing ever, because it, like, when you can actually look someone in the eyes, it's almost like you're looking deeper than them. It's like looking into their soul a little bit.
Yes. That's so beautiful. And I so appreciate that. One, setting limits and boundaries is so hard. It seems to be one of the hardest things to do in relationships. And it takes practice. And
yes,
if with practice, it gets better and better. And it's really, it's like one of the top self-care things we can do for ourselves. And I think you're so right that there's many tools and tips and techniques we can learn that help. And I love that idea, right? That you bring someone into connection, and it's much, as I'm hearing you say it, if I make sure I got it right, that when somebody is seeing you see them, that you know loves, it's much harder to not be gentle in a way. It's much harder. When we're not looking at somebody, we can sort of bring up other parts of ourselves, right, that we resort to and have resorted to in life, and just kind of dish out kind of the same old defensive reaction.
But when
looking towards us, somebody like you, particularly with those beautiful doughy eyes.
You're so sweet.
Who could be mean to that?
Yeah, I think they get my fiance pretty well.
Yeah.
So I do want to talk a little bit about, why do you feel like anxiety is so prevalent in our culture right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a layup for me. So if we know that anxiety is a signal that we're burying or suppressing or avoiding, whatever you want to call it, our core emotions, and we know that we live in a society that that teaches us all these myths and mantras, like, you're weak if you have emotions, and you better just get over it and just pick yourself up by your bootstraps, and all these mantras that do such damage. So we're all, our society provides no education in emotions. I mean, they're just starting in elementary school to kind of have where you're teaching a little bit of emotional literacy and mindfulness and taking a breath and those things. But without kind of the information that I learned and that I put into the book, it makes perfect sense why everybody's walking around anxious, because everybody's blocking their true feelings. People don't know what to do with them. What do you do when you have this big feeling, right? This big wave of anger, or this big wave of sadness, and you have that in you're feeling that, and then you have these cultural messages that say, you know, nobody wants to hear about my feelings. So we push them down, and it makes us anxious. And if that happens again and again over our lifetimes, usually starts in childhood, right? We're modeled by our parents. We get these messages in our schools, in our peer groups, in our religions, and there's nobody undoing them. Like at school, I can't get over the fact that, again, in elementary schools and high schools, when with bullying, for example, to me, as soon as there's a bullying moment that is being witnessed, right? So we could talk about, not only does that create lifelong trauma, because I have so many patients where we're trying to heal parts that were bullied and parts that did the bullying, that it creates, these experiences create a tremendous amount of anxiety. And if we could, in a moment at a school, have an hour once a week set aside to talk about emotions and what is happening, you know, kids, it's very hard because kids don't, you have to be very clever with the way you talk to kids about emotions, less clever with adults. That's why I like working with adults. But just to through examples and through some basic learning, explain that these ways that we behave have everything to do with what we're feeling inside. and that when kids are mean to other kids, it's because they're feeling bad. And if there's other reasons, like they were just modeled by their parents to be entitled, then those kids have to be taught empathy. And that what that does, the concept that the way you behave, that we're all connected, affects somebody deeply. And is that the intent? And if there is a desire to hurt or make someone feel bad, let's try to understand that, or at least tell children and adults that there's enough room in this world for everybody to feel good. There's this concept a lot of people feel on some deep visceral level that if I feel big and good about myself, somebody else has to feel small. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that like makes sense or resonates as I'm saying it, but a lot of times it happens like in the therapy room, where if I try to help someone, a lot of what we do in AEDP is preference positive emotions, because by helping people feel their joy and their joie de vivre and their excitement and their vitality, that often is the other way to healing the depression and anxiety, because we're often the actual depression and anxiety is inhibiting those expansive emotions that we're wired to feel. And a lot of what people tell me is that, well, I'm afraid to feel big. I don't want to dig into how, quote, you know, proud I am of myself, because I don't want you to feel bad. And then it gives me an opportunity to say, you know, where did you learn that if you feel good, that it's going to make me feel bad? And granted, some people do get jealous. Many people feel jealousy and envy. But again, in a way, it's natural, but it's also a symptom, I think, of a society that doesn't explain emotions and teach people how to connect positively, and explains when things aren't going well, why, and what you can do about that.
Yeah, I think I can see that kind of take shape with how social media is set up. I think a lot of people have a hard time processing, you know, somebody else's success without either putting themselves down or putting somebody else down.
Exactly.
And it's interesting, because a lot of that is very like kind of smoke and mirrors. Like it's not really reality. So it's like, it's really hard on the psychology of your experience. Have you worked with individuals who struggle with kind of like online, whether it be bullying or social media comparison? Like, is that prevalent in your practice?
Yeah, I think it affects everybody. And you're right, it's multi-layered. The first thing is knowing that it is smoke and mirrors, and that everybody suffers. Everybody suffers. I mean, it's just a fact, just like it's a fact that we all have emotions, and emotions just are. They're not bad. They're not good. They may feel bad, but there's nothing to judge. It just is.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a great example, that you look at someone having a great family vacation, and it's triggering of, it sort of reverberates down the brain. People naturally compare. I think that's a part of the just things that humans do. But I always say, I can't remember where I learned this, but it was a great phrase, compare and despair, because that's what happens.
Yeah.
And to be able to hold in mind that two things. One, that everybody suffers and you're seeing a flash moment. And if it's upsetting you consistently, to try to resist, right? It becomes very addictive. But also this idea, which I was just writing about on my Instagram today, this idea that I think of judgment as a defense on the change triangle, right? And even though it's something that many of us do naturally, and perhaps, and again, a natural propensity of the human brain, it's a defense in that it there's an underlying feeling that really needs to be validated, because ultimately judging ourselves is very damaging. But whether we judge others or judge ourselves, they seem to go hand in hand. When people judge others about something, I often ask someone when they're talking about other people and judging this and judging that, I ask, do you judge yourself that harshly? And virtually everyone goes, I judge myself. And so we're like, okay, well, why don't we need to pay attention to these judging parts and understand where they came from, what their purpose is, how they're serving you, because it doesn't feel so good, and what the underlying feeling is. So if you see somebody having a great vacation on Instagram or Facebook, what feelings does it bring up? you know, I feel sad. It's a loss. I wish I had a family that had vacations like that. And then that is like so understandable. And let's be with that sadness. Let's make space for that sadness so you can process it. And then think about how you can create that for yourself if that's important to you. Or maybe it makes you angry because, again, I'm angry that my parents didn't ever take me on a family vacation. Well, let's be with that anger and let's process it so it doesn't have like a repeating thing for the rest of your life. You can process the anger from whence it came in your childhood so you can move on. And again, use that anger to assert so you can have those things in your life so you're not stuck in a loop of feeling miserable.
So it's really about the validation of your present moment experience.
Yes. Yes. And through that validation of your present moment experience, there'll be a link through these neural networks to the past experiences. And it's going to happen through the body, which you know is so important. So what that looks like is, again, in action is this feeling of anger that you have because you never got to go on family vacations. If you tune into that in your body and how you feel that feeling, and then I give someone time to do that. And now as you kind of bridge back in your life to see when's the first time you ever felt that way. And then all of a sudden we've landed in at age 9 or something like that. And then we can try to process and heal that young part, and that will clear something out. So then we can again approach somebody's adult self where there's tools now to get those needs met.
Yeah. So that takes a lot of compassion to really be with and stay with and be kind to that little human inside of you that was struggling.
Yeah. It does take a lot of compassion, and a lot of people have to spend some time being able to allow themselves to have compassion for their younger parts. They're angry at their younger parts because they hold a lot of feelings that torture the adults.
Yeah.
But so a lot of the work is, you know, is putting aside, in a single session, it's amazing when you ask someone, you know, if you put aside the anger you have towards that 9-year-old part of you, what do you feel then? Well, now I just feel, frightened for them. And if you put aside the fear that you have, what do you feel then? Well, now I feel some compassion. Okay. Mm. And what is in that, if you stay with that, are you moved to do something for that young part of yours? I mean, before that, we're like, how do you see them? You try to light up the memory, meaning where are you? What scene? What do you see?
Create an image.
Right, because you're trying to light up that neural network vividly. Mm-hmm. So this is where the neuroscience, informs the theory. But in session, we don't get heady like that. Unless somebody says, this is so hokey. And I'm like, yeah, it is hokey and it works. So can you I'll say, if I'm with a very intellectual person and I'm in Manhattan, so I get a lot of sort of very heady people, I'm like, I know this sounds hokey, but, can you sort of just see if you can put your adult self into this memory, and would it be okay if you tried to connect to this young part of yours? And again, if you give enough rational reason for it and reconnect in the way a particular person needs to connect, they will go there. It's in the realm of right brain, dreamy experience, the way we dream, where you can use creativity and fantasy, which we use a lot of in this work, to heal.
Yeah, I love it. So my last question is, why did you name the book It's Not Always Depression?
Well, I have a very specific answer for that. And that is, I can't take credit for it. When I submitted that first article that I wanted to write about this work that I was doing that I felt was helping, I wrote about a particular patient named Brian, and I submitted the op-ed to the New York Times. Never thinking in a million years, I wasn't a writer and I never thought that they would submit it, but I do like to try things. And they said they were going to run the article, and the editor came up with the title, and he called it, It's Not Always Depression, Sometimes It's Shame. Because it was an article about someone who had an untreatable depression, which many people have. They've had 20 years of different treatments, different therapies, in and out of psychiatric hospitals, cocktails of medications, And when I met this person, having learned this trauma-informed, this whole way of different way of looking at people, not diagnosing, but just understanding people in terms of the trials and tribulations they've been through, I sort of didn't want to redo what had already been done, just call them depressed. Because I think depression is the beginning of a story, not the end of a story. Same thing with anxiety.
Yes.
Exactly. So I reconceptualized this person as being... having a shame-based depression from emotional neglect, and he got better. And that's when I thought it was the first time in my life I felt I actually had something to say. So I wrote it down, and the publisher called it, "It's Not Always Depression, Sometimes It's Shame." And it's a good article for people who are interested in what we're talking about, just as a good introduction to this work. And then Random House, when they were naming the title of the book, decided to go with it. I think they're using a lot of Google terms, so they knew that the article went viral and it was so popular that they wanted to use that same name. And they wanted, they didn't want to call it Emotion Education 101. Although some people have said maybe that would have been a better title. But what I mean by that, and it creates curiosity, is people have said, so if it's not always depression, what is it? And the answer is, it's life.
Yeah. That is the most true. I love that story so much. And I think it really encapsulates kind of what I said at the beginning, how this book is just inherently human. Like, it just makes you feel so heard and seen as a human, connected with you as a writer. And it's such a great experience. So that link to buy the book is going to be in the show notes. So I recommend everyone get the book. Where can people find you if they want to interact with you?
Yeah, well, I do want to say that I the book is the whole enchilada, and there's lots, it's mostly stories. And I really wrote it so that like an intelligent 15-year-old could understand it. So it's really accessible. There's no jargon. I tried to keep out the psychobabble, bullshit type stuff. And if I may say that. So it's just supposed to be a nice sort of beach read on emotions. That's compelling. But for people that don't like to read, the book is on audio, but also on my website at hilaryjacobshendel.com or thechangetriangle.com. There's tons of shorter pieces. There's articles, there's videos, there's experiential videos of, there's the Change Triangle YouTube. And then I'm just everywhere in social media, not because I like social media, because I don't, but it's a great place to share educational resources. So I have a blog that I send an article once a month. And if someone is interested in this type of work and interested in emotional health, I would love if they signed up, if they like that idea. And once a month, they'd get an article, no spam, or I'm not selling anything at this point. Maybe one day I'll do some webinars. so they can find me everywhere. And it's
perfect.
Just Google The Change Triangle or Hilary Jacobs Hendel, H-E-N-D-E-F.
All right, Hilary, thank you so much for all of your insight and wisdom.
Thank you, Danielle, for letting me talk about my favorite subject. <laughs>